Trinity, when law wasn't at the heart of it. And law was never good in any context if good language and accurate language, accurate use of language wasn't in the heart of it. And with the deterioration in the quality of journalists from that age on, things really started to become really bad. And that, in my opinion, added more seeds that will help us understand why the media scene in Egypt now is so vulgar. The seeds of that aspect of it is in that. But the seeds of cracking down on it, of course, goes back to Nasser's time. And now, we move from that age to the what I call the age of do nothing. That's because Mubarak, who succeeded Sadat, truly he believed in, you know, if you did little, then possibilities that something goes wrong will be very little too, right? It makes sense, right? It makes sense. It's something. I mean, some individuals believe in that. Yeah, I mean, yeah, fine. That really wipes out everything that's to do with the role of Egypt as a big player in the region and internationally as well. That's something that, you know, beyond the comprehension of the likes of Mubarak, Sadat understood to a certain extent, but played it in a certain flavor. Nasser definitely understood it. But Mubarak had an issue with that. He really didn't understand what Egypt is all about and what it can offer and how you can build those certain things and the rest of it. Well, this is, by the way, one of my colleagues who worked with me on my show during the revolution spotted this, his suit. The suit was actually written on it, and then I don't, it's not big enough that you can see. Hosni Mubarak, Hosni Mubarak, Hosni Mubarak, Hosni Mubarak, Hosni Mubarak, Hosni Mubarak. So I've. Okay, that's. Corruption. Corruption, of course, is something. It's not nothing, okay? And that feature stayed in Egypt, and it became to be. It really. When you do nothing, having laid the foundations for corruption in the middle of 1970s, then something big in the end will accumulate, which actually happened. Now, at the same time, and actually starting from from the mid-1970s, the Saudis were coming along. There was a very bitter enmity between Nasser and Al Saud in the 60s. But that changed during the 1973 war and later on. And with King Fahd of Saudi, that we know from certain decisions that had been taken then, they shifted a lot of their investments from like hardcore investments into media with a strategic plan to be able to control the product in art, music, culture, and media, of course. And they did it through different ways. They started by buying a lot of our archives, which was facilitated a lot. They did it through launching new channels, newspapers, buying off existing newspapers and media outlets in general, buying off individuals, bribing individuals. There is no other name for it than this. They are still doing it. They still go, they take people to do Hajj, prominent journalists in Egypt, and lavish festivities and what have you. Now, I have no problem. Every country can decide what's good for it and what's not good. But I do have a problem with my country and the government of my country when it has every reason to be really out there leading the entire region fairly in front of a player like, with all due respect to my Saudi friends and the entire of the Saudi people. That really, you had to, I'm sorry to use the word, you had to fuck up big time to be taken over completely in that manner. It all started from the mid-1970s, but it really peaked with the proof to the whole world that a small operation can, media operation can actually sway the entire international public opinion. That was the first Gulf War, 1990. CNN. CNN was the, and CNN actually was the thing that prompted the Saudis to launch a TV channel out of London called NBC. John Major, the former prime minister, actually cut the ribbon for it. And now you start to see how money gets into the issue with big interests, army deals, big, huge army deals, and the rest of it. And the Saudis really loved going into that sector, hijacking this sector. Now, even though there was this bitter enmity between the Egyptian government and the Saudi monarchy in the 60s, they always agreed on one thing, the strategic aim of taking an interest in media, which is basically, I want to go into media, alam, so that in the end, there's actually no media, no alam. That's the strategic thing. Basically, the two major hypotheses, and I put this to the test in my own thesis for the master degree at AUC, whether or not the literary product on Egypt radio, does it reinforce the status quo or does it encourage change? And of course, you can guess the answer. And that was the main strategic aim which both governments actually agreed upon. We're here to try and keep. Now, so with someone like Hosni Mubarak, he loves, of course, status quo. I mean, we don't want change. Do nothing. But the Saudis were doing something at the same time. So they really started taking over the Egyptians by miles now. And all the so-called commander of the Egyptian media battalion, Qaid al-Katiba al-Alamiya al-Misriya, the Minister of Information, Safwat Sharif, satisfied Mubarak every now and then with actually a bunch of TV station and radio stations every year, festivities and the rest of it. Numbers, 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 and the rest. And then a word of appreciation, though, for channels like NBC, the Saudi NBC, which came out of the, it was the first pan-Arab TV channel, and it introduced some good value visually. So that at least you get to see a clean picture. You get the shape of what a news story is actually, as opposed to, you know, how they used to do things at the time. They just get the Reuters feed or the or the Associated Press feed, and they run it with a text that was written in a completely different room, and you hit the picture or you don't, doesn't matter, and that kind of thing. A little bit of professionally on the technical side, but not on the editorial side. The editorial side started with this, a completely different approach. Now, when the Saudis realized that the BBC were thinking of launching a news channel out of London, they went into partnership with them through a network called Orbit. I was part of that project, and I lived it, the experience. And it was, that was the reason why I decided to leave my PhD and to resign from the university. I thought that was the opportunity, the BBC launching a TV channel, a news channel in Arabic. I was lucky to be selected with a lot of my colleagues from all over, actually from the four corners of the world. BBC are very good at this. It is a big school in the entire world when it comes to this. But when I thought about this project later on, I thought that this probably was, at least as far as I'm concerned, the very first time in history that someone goes into a certain project with someone else as a partner with the aim that the product of that project doesn't get distributed around. That basically was the aim of the Saudis. Yeah, we will finance you. I mean, the deal was the Saudis will finance and the BBC will recruit and oversee the editorial policy and the rest of it. But the Saudis had other ideas, that we're here to, you know, be part of the editorial policy, even though, you know, it's not in the contract, but, you know, we pay the money and the rest of it. Of course, the BBC wouldn't take that kind of thing. And things started to get bad. And in the end, it was a bad marriage, and each of them was waiting for the other to say to them, divorce me so that they can take the penalty clause. In the end, the Saudis, actually, they said, how much? Take the money, close it down. Now, the BBC had every reason to stay on air. Every single reason. They had already recruited people from the four corners of the world. They had already trained them. They had already been working for two years. They had the infrastructure. They had the penalty clause cash, which could have kept the service on air for at least 2-3 years. And they had other parties actually interested in taking over. And they had the other option by which BBC World Service English works, which is like, you know, make it commercial to a certain extent. I mean, in a respectable way. I mean, this is how BBC World Service English is financed. Commercially, it doesn't take its money from the government or from the tuition fees. But actually, the Saudis said, no, you can't do this. Even though they had no rights whatsoever, you're out. They went to the British government at the time, and I remember very well the Defense Minister, Michael Portillo, and they said, basically, either the BBC Arabic service closes down or the Yamama army deal is void. And that Yamama army deal was worth at least 43 billion sterling. Now, this is really, and I find it flattering, by the way, very flattering that a government like the Saudi monarchy considers us to be that valuable. It tells you everything about why dictators and people who want to stand in the face of evolution, sanity, logic, is that valuable. And I take heart from a bad example like this. So I find it very good. Because immediately after the closure of BBC World Service Arabic, guess what happened? Al Jazeera took over.